Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the CEOs, leaders, clinicians and investors that are leading the health tech revolution in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am the CEO and founder of a health tech company myself called PocDoc. PocDoc sponsor this show, so thank you very much to them. We are delivering the full cardiovascular pathway digitally for the first time via an app, including a 5-marker cholesterol panel, all in under 10 minutes. So that means that wherever you are, at home, or in a pharmacy, or wherever, you can check your cardiovascular health. We're working with the NHS and we're working with pharmacies. The reason I mention this is I want to tap in to the wider listener network. I know that we have a pretty broad church of people listening, but I thought it would be fun, given that we're currently rolling out in pharmacies and across a number of areas in the UK via the NHS. If there is anyone listening that runs a pharmacy or knows someone that runs a pharmacy, or if anyone is interested from an NHS perspective, please get in touch with the show. We're looking for new areas where we can roll out. So either find me on LinkedIn, it's Steve Roost, or on the socials, it's at Steve Roost, or go to mypocdoc.co.uk. That's mypocdoc.co.uk. And let's try and revolutionize the way that we assess cardiovascular disease. Now, on to today's show. Well, first of all, thank you to everyone for listening, whether you're listening live on the amazing UK Health Radio. Johan and his team are doing a fantastic job in growing the station. It's an honor to be on every week. If you miss my show or if you miss any of the others, UK Health Radio is now up live on all of the podcast platforms. I know that we have our own channel as well where you can catch our shows. And we're also available on YouTube. So thank you very much for everyone, however you're tuning in and however you are here with us. So on today's show, we have a super interesting organization on today's show called LifeArc. It wasn't something I was completely familiar with prior to getting the guest on the show, but having done my research, it is fantastically interesting, and I'm super excited to do the show. We have Dr. Melanie Lee, who's their CEO, on the show. Melanie's been involved in life science research and development, biotech, and cancer research for over 30 years. And LifeArc is a not-for-profit that funds scientific research and innovation and companies and innovators to help bring early scientific discoveries to us, to patients, help bridge what's called the valley of death between people coming up with an idea in academia and it actually ending up in patients. They predominantly focus on diagnostics, treatments, or cures in the space of neurodegeneration, which has become increasingly referred to as MND, so motor neuron disease, which has been in the news time and time and time and time again. Is actually on BBC this morning, BBC Breakfast this morning, more around impact trauma, head impact trauma, leading to neurodegeneration. But again, with I think it's Rob Burrows, the guy who was used to play for Leeds Rhinos. There's a big campaign about him, so it's in the news quite a bit. And respiratory diseases. So as an organization, LifeArc have pledged to fund £1.3 billion worth of projects by 2030, which is a lot of funding for an organization that isn't governmental in any way, shape, or form. That's a huge amount of money. In fact, I think that might even be more than some of the Innovate UK budgets, actually, which is governmental. That's an interesting one we can get into. So anyway, Melanie, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, look, it's really interesting to talk about your organization, LifeArc. So I think just before sometimes I start the show in different ways. Sometimes we jump straight into the subject matter. Sometimes we like to try and make sure that we're all on the same page because it's kind of a broad church of listeners. So what might be helpful just to start with is, could you just give us a couple of, you know, just give us a couple of minutes on what life is, what LifeArc is, and where it kind of came from? Because I think it's a really interesting player in the life science ecosystem. And I just kind of think it'd be really interesting for the listeners to hear that from you.
Yeah, sure. Well, LifeArc is, it's been formed about 5 years as LifeArc, and it has its roots with Medical Research Council Technology, which was a tech transfer office that also added scientists into the organization so that not only could we help academics on behalf of the Medical Research Council move their innovations forward to help them take scientific ideas and findings into products, but we could also, with the scientists' help, actually help to increase the opportunity, impact, and utility of some of the technologies that they developed. Mm-hmm. So we have a long history, but around about 5 years ago, the Medical Research Council spun us off as an independent medical charity. And part of the reason for that was the opportunity that was going to come our way to get a royalty stream from a drug that we'd had a lot of interaction with many years before, that was actually looking like it was going to deliver really high quality and value to patients. So we started life as LifeArc, and we monetized a royalty stream. So we're now independent, and we're going to put all our money, efforts, and everything we do back into that translation space, particularly on behalf of UK researchers, but not exclusively for UK-based patients.
Wow. So let's just unpick that a little bit. I've heard of the Medical Research Council. I'm sure many people have. That's one of those terms or kind of acronyms that gets thrown around a little bit. So what exactly was that, and where did that come from?
Well, that is a government-funded organisation. So that does fall under today. It falls under UKRI. So now the relationship we have with Medical Research Council is as a technology transfer partner, so a translation partner. But we are now independent and able to work across many strong research organizations to help them with translation.
Okay. And what was the drug that you got royalties for?
That drug was Keytruda. It's marketed by Merck, and we originally had a hand in turning the original antibody that became Keytruda into, we used a technology called humanization to humanize the antibody so it was going to be able to go into human beings without causing problems with the immune system. So we humanized it for a company called Organon. Organon were bought by Shearing Plough. Shearing Plough were bought by Merck. Merck then marketed it. And it's probably the most successful, one of the most successful drugs in the world. It's an antibody drug, and it really, really transforms the lives of many, many end-stage cancer patients.
Okay, so it's for use in end-stage terminal cancer. What does it do?
Well, what solid tumors do is they manage to protect themselves from the patient's immune system very well by protecting their outer layer, and they put little signals up that stop the immune system from penetrating the tumor. Mm-hmm. This drug is a PD-1 inhibitor, and it actually blocks some of those protective signals, and in doing so, it allows the human immune system in to start to fight the cancer. So it's what we call immunotherapy, immuno-oncology therapy. And it's really revolutionizing the oncology space.
Is it used earlier in the cycle, or is it just always used in the end stage?
Well, mainly as a newly launched drug, it was used in the end stage patients.
Right.
But more and more, I believe that its strategy is to bring it earlier into the treatment of patients.
Okay, cool. I think that's a really unique story. So whoever made that decision at the Medical Research Council, congratulations for a huge amount of foresight, which isn't always the case. So good job, people. Got it right this time. And so what's life as a charity been like?
Life as a Charity for Life Arc is really exciting because when we did monetize the royalty stream, we actually worked with the Canadian Pension Fund. They actually bought the royalty stream, and that's what they gave us the £1.3 billion for. So we have the money and we have the ambition. We're an organization of about 250 people, maybe soon to be 300, mixture of scientists, lawyers, financiers, investors, human resources, everybody you need, comms. But our ambition is to take our industrial training, which is where most of us as scientists come from, and use that to everything we've learned, use it to help research understand the potential of their science to create new products for patients.
And was that always whatever the iteration of LifeArc before it was spun out, has that always been the mission, or is this a new mission after reforming or being spun out as a charity?
The space is what you call translation, that movement of ideas to products. The ambition now, of course, can be far greater than it ever was, which is the really exciting piece about being in LifeArc at the time. And LifeArc's only just on the cusp of building its reputation externally, so it's absolutely forgivable, but the people don't really know about it in its current form. But we now have the opportunity to work with major academic groups in the UK, so that's who we're aligning with, and we encourage this process of translation. So we look at science, we look at scientific findings, we look at opportunities, and then we actually work with little charities as well that have also invested in research, and we actually say, what could this research mean to patients? And then when we actually have an idea mechanistically and opportunity, what's the opportunity for that product? Is it to make a diagnostic? Is it to create a device? Is it to treat a patient? What is it? And then when we know that, then we actually decide whether or not we open up a translational challenge. And I can talk more about those, but those are the large investment vehicles, multi-project programs that we will work with to make the translation happen.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I've always thought it's sort of an interesting quirk of the media landscape, where one of the reasons why I started the show was to give organizations and companies and innovators more of a broadcast platform to get their kind of longer form mission out there, because I felt like in the general broadcast media space it was very sort of announcement driven and message driven, as opposed to sort of being able to more broadly talk about things that are actually quite complicated and quite complex and lots of different moving parts and all this kind of stuff. However, the broadcast media loves an announcement about early stage scientific findings of wonder drugs. And they love it. And I read these things and I'm like, you're talking like 15 years, if ever, from when that's going to. But I don't think the general public really realize that, right? Like, is that sort of part of the issue around the translation work that you guys do, is trying to figure out what of this scientific research is even going to go anywhere? It's like, congratulations, you did a piece of research in, I don't know, a small number of potentially samples, but there's still a long way to go before it hits a patient.
Yeah, you're very right, Steve. In fact, most of my career was spent in pharma. So pharma's got these really long timelines, sometimes 25 years from an idea or a piece of science moving to a product on the market for patients. But LifeArc strategy is going to be more fun than that, because we're looking for, I think the time is right for multi-tech working together. And so we will take on projects that will deliver information that could be form the base of an app like your work, to patients, that we could diagnostics like your work, devices, right all the way through to therapies that may take much longer to bring. And so, because I believe wholeheartedly in the time for improving the efficiency and speed with which we can do R&D, I also believe that some of the answers will come from technologies that we introduce into the space. And so, and we also know, if you empower patients with information, you end up with a faster track to the specialists that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really interesting approach, particularly one that challenges the kind of the normal time frames and timescales, and, you know, tries to help speed things up. Because there's a reality that, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, you might know more than me, but of academic research in the scientific space that translates into actual real world, you know, products, services, treatments is, I would imagine, relatively low. You know, and a lot of that will be because there might be some real gems there that aren't being supported in the way that they should be just due to the funding landscape.
Yes, there are numerous reasons why ideas don't make it through to products, not least of which is the difficulty, the complexity of what the decisions are, and then the many pitfalls that you can go into trying to develop a therapeutic. Mm. But I believe at the moment that we've seen, particularly from the COVID era, that empowering the patient is a tremendous tool to actually getting people to make good choices about themselves, their health, and actually fast-tracking themselves to get the right treatment. So there are many angles that LifeArc's going at this from. It's not just about the right therapy for patients, but it's about revolutionising the world of the patient so that they're all together more informed, more empowered, more enabled to take some responsibility. And there are lots of other elements that make the chances of success of translation from science to therapy it's a very high risk area, but yeah, I think we can improve that risk with some clever integration of data and technology up front.
Like what? So actually, just let's take a step back, let's make sure everyone's on the same page about what we're talking about with translation. So I think I understand it, but just really basically, what is this translation piece, and why is it really critical in bringing therapies, drugs, treatments to market?
Yeah, it's a good question. So why it's critical is because the world of academia is about deep biology, deep understanding of chemistry, and sometimes the longer term application is not the object of the research. It's to really go deep into understanding something. If you're a translational scientist or you've been trained in industry, you tend to ask questions of what's the mechanism we're talking about? Where might you find this gene expressed, if you're talking about a gene? How might this be a target to disrupt a process that's gone wrong? So translation is that analytical set of steps that takes you from finding to potential product.
Yeah, and understanding, I would assume, the patient need, the system need.
Always.
You know, and trying to, I mean, we obviously have had quite a lot of interaction with academia and things like that. My background is not academic. So some of the first interactions between myself and academics were quite interesting when, you know, it was fairly clear that there's as much, they get as much joy, potentially more, from the journey as from the destination, whereas entrepreneurs and business people are pretty focused on the destination as a target of where we need to get to.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And there is a big difference, but they do very well together.
Oh, well, look, let's be totally honest. It's you require a sort of a critical mass. This is the way I think about it, a critical mass of scientific innovation and research and stuff to be happening, almost like a kind of a soup of ideas and thoughts and early stage things for then other people to interact with and say, well, hold up a second, that can actually fit over here and we can do that with this. If you don't have that first bit, then you're in all kinds of trouble, I think.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, we definitely benefit by working together. And that's the way that we can boost innovation for the UK, especially.
Well, we are going to come on to that very subject, because most recently, the government's been very keen on, you know, lumbering the science and technology industries with quite a lot of pressure of delivery and, you know, being a major cornerstone or even bigger cornerstone of the UK economy. So we're going to stop for a couple of minutes commercial break now. After that, I want to jump into your work on the two specific areas that you certainly highlight sort of publicly. I know you do quite a bit, but MND, look, you do quite a spread of things, but MND and respiratory, as to why you've chosen those and what the work is going on, because particularly MND is very much in the headlines, like we talked about at the beginning of the show. And yeah, I think it'd be really, really interesting to try and unpick that. So we will be back in 2 minutes with my guest, Dr. Melanie Lee, the CEO of LifeArc.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with myself, Steve Roost, and my guest, Dr. Melanie Lee, the CEO of LifeArc. Okay, Melanie, before the break, we were just about to kind of get on to a couple of the disease areas that LifeArc has spent some time focusing on. One is motor neurone disease and the other is respiratory diseases. Should we start with motor neurone disease? I think to kick off, yeah, it would be interesting for me as to why you did choose that area and what is it specifically about that area where you think, you know, why could LifeArc help so much in that area, if that makes any sense? So yeah, over to you.
Sure. Thank you very much. So we are working through a system of translational challenges, and we chose, and that is a big program which can have multiple projects, which, as I said before, can cover anything from a diagnostic digital device or drug type focus. Yep. We chose MND because we had quite close connections with the whole ecosystem of MND, which, as you rightly said, from this morning's announcements on the television, for example, is very closely connected community, a very active community, and very strongly involved with patients. Yep. So we already had that established in the UK. And when we looked at it, one of the things that we make as a criterion is, can we do any good ourselves? Can LifeArc, okay, becoming part of that, actually do something? And when we connected with the charities, My Name's Doddy and the MND Association, etc., we realized that we could do something. In fact, we could bring our industrial knowledge of translation into their ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And by coordinating and using our knowledge around there, we actually realized that despite this being a most debilitating and serious disease, it actually was a failed commercial opportunity in many respects.
It's, oh, really?
Quite rare. It's quite a rare disease and not one that was receiving considerable commercial attention. So that's an ideal opportunity. So we talk to patients and their charities. And of course, the real hope for these patients is that we get a cure. But unfortunately, the diagnostic phase of this is when the disease clinically manifests. And yep, this is actually when patients are on quite a steep decline.
Okay. Is that because the diagnosis at the moment happens from sort of cognitive basis, i.e. visible symptoms that can be then visibly noted or somewhat like speech, verbal, memory, retention, as opposed to a diagnostic blood test, which could detect markers way earlier?
Exactly. And it's even it's really interesting, Steve, because those clinical markers also do not distinguish the underlying cause of their own disease between different patients.
Yep.
So to actually do something to treat patients late stage when you've got clinical markers that are not indicative of mechanism is actually too late. So one of the real unmet needs was earlier diagnosis and then earlier understanding through that diagnosis the mechanisms that are actually the underlying cause of the disease. So it became obvious to us that there were several projects that we could identify. One would be means of proper diagnosis that would point to mechanism, making sure that's readily available to patients to see if they are at risk, and if they are at risk, what categories do they fall into, and could they in some way avoid that risk? Then just by doing that, you actually open up that area of patients who are at risk. And maybe they may be not only more easy to treat because they're actually earlier in the stage of their disease, but you may get the treatment much better because you know specifically what's actually going wrong. So, and there's repurposing opportunities in there as well with established drugs, which is a faster route.
Okay, so let's just try and unpick some of that. So let's go from the beginning, which is diagnosis, through to treatment, through to cure. Cure is obviously where we all want to get to.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see where we go. That's presumably, I would imagine, still in research zone, although actually I've heard of some things that might be coming out. One of a good friend of mine that went to university actually has a big lab in Edinburgh and is hopefully, touch wood, onto something in this space. Yeah. So so let's talk about diagnosis. So is there currently a way to do a blood-based or other sample-based diagnosis for MND? Or what is, you know, an earlier version of that diagnosis other than a cognitive assessment?
I don't believe there is a blood-based way at the moment. There may be, so I may be wrong about that. There is certainly distinction between different patients with EEG. So when you measure their brain function. And what I did read, and I wouldn't consider myself to be the expert at this stage, but I did read a paper where there were at least four categories, and I believe there may even be more now, of MND patient that report on the basis of their EEG signal, and that's quite early on, and that those are considered very robust markers that don't change through the life of the patient.
That's really interesting, because presumably the earlier that you can diagnose, the earlier that you can treat. And you mentioned things about repurposing existing treatments and things like that. So are there effective treatments in this space or not really at the moment, and we're waiting for some new things to come out?
Amongst the advanced therapies that exist, there's just such a plethora of opportunities now to treat patients on the basis of distinct mechanisms, once you can identify what mechanism's going wrong. There are also opportunities, as you see in breakthrough medicines, for gene therapies and gene editing solutions to diseases. So there is, in fact, I think it's a small RNA molecule that is actually treating one tiny subset of MND patients who have a particular genetic mutation. So these things will come. They will come quite fast, I believe. And the importance of LifeArt being in the space is putting money there to really bring to the fore those who have solutions when market size might be quite small, but the actual benefit to patients will be huge. And that is the criterion that LifeArt puts into where we go.
And presumably, but I don't know because I've not looked into it, the cost to healthcare services of people that have MND is probably quite high.
Yes.
So there's an argument from which sounds harsh, but from an economic perspective for health services to be interested in this area, because any reduction in costs could be pretty sizable with better treatments and or a cure.
Absolutely. Yeah, the cost of the patient in the normal course of disease is astronomical in terms of healthcare. But of course, the patient journey, which we believe is so important, give better quality of life, better opportunity to avoid or delay or ameliorate symptoms. That is enormous too. So we believe if we get therapies that will match that benefit for patients, then the cost won't be an issue.
No, I mean, from a patient quality of life perspective, it's sort of almost immeasurable, I would imagine. So you mentioned I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page, because I think particularly when I watched the BBC News this morning, even with newsreaders and things like that, they should know there's still a bit of blurring around the edges about what's what and what's not that. So, for example, motor neuron disease is not... is not necessarily, or I don't know if it includes the collision trauma encephalopathy. That's different, I believe, right? So that's not concussion. It's not concussion caused or anything like that. That's different, right?
Well, I think,
or is
I think,
it all in the same family?
I don't think we know, Steve. I think that's the problem. I don't think we know.
Oh, okay.
What we believe is that there may be a genetic element, genetic cause development, which puts patients at risk. In fact, there certainly is an element of genetics, which there are some familial predispositions.
Okay.
It may be trauma, and because of your genetics, trauma is more impactful for some than for others in terms of predisposition to disease.
That predisposition must be anecdotal, seems anecdotally accurate, because otherwise everybody that played rugby would have, you know what I mean? Like there would be a much higher incidence, unless there must be some predisposition, I would think.
I would have thought so. It could be the type of injury, though. It could be the position that these people play. It could, and then of course, the majority of patients, it's an aging process. So again, we don't know what the cause of that is. But one this is all very anecdotal, and I don't want to be quoted as an expert. But one really enlightened clinician said, who does treat a lot of patients, said to me, he just wonders if extreme athletic performance is actually correlated with the person's ability to actually damage themselves in a particular way. Mm. And it's to do with oxygen utilization in the muscles, for example. So, so there are lots of wonderful.
Wow. That's quite a theory, isn't it? Blimey.
It is a theory. So you would get top sportsmen, but the very fact that they can be like that, and women, the very fact they can be like that may make them more predisposed. So who knows, but it may lead to better, safer training methods.
Well,
who
it
knows?
Has to. I mean, it just has to, and particularly because of the hype, like Doddy Weir, and is it Rob Burrows, and there was the England hooker, what was his name, Steve somebody or other, and there was a Welsh guy, Ryan Jones, recently. Like, you know, I just can't see this not becoming something that they have to really, really, really look at. I just can't see it. It has to happen.
So that's the beauty of our program, is that we will. We talk to patients, we're guided by the experts in the field, and we are actually very open-minded about where our funding can benefit. And we want to have short, medium, as well as long-term results for patients.
That makes sense. Yeah, right, exactly. That makes sense. So you've got some things moving through the pipeline while somebody or some other people are working on the moonshot, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what successes have you, or are, well, you might be at the beginning, so it might be a bit early, but have you got any sort of case studies or successes in the MND space, or what are you most excited about that you're involved in that you can talk about in this space, so to speak?
In the MND space? Well, it's very early for us, I think, in the MND space. So I really don't have significant results at this stage that I can talk about. All I can see at the moment is that the number of projects that are building are really exciting. I think the repurposing programs, where there'll be, once we think different mechanisms are going to be involved, the repurposing program enables us to look up drugs that are involved in those mechanisms, mm-hmm. and then actually do some research to understand, might they be beneficial to these patients. So that will evolve.
So I just want to pick up on that, because I think that's a really interesting area. My wife used to work in pharma, and it was one of the areas that she worked on for a while, and it was super interesting to me, this idea of repurposing. So I think that just because, like you kind of said it as a throwaway comment earlier about how that can save a lot of time, because these things have already been, drugs or treatments have been licensed for one thing, but they could well be repurposed to another thing, which would be easier.
Because if you look at underlying mechanisms of neurodegeneration, they're very multifaceted. They could be inflammation, it can be myelin sheath degeneration.
Yeah.
It can be glial cell infiltration into different parts of the brain. It can be all sorts of reasons for damage. Mm-hmm. And there are drugs that actually work on those mechanisms to treat other diseases. And so the question that there are breakthroughs with repurposing medicines that are quite well known across the world. And it really, because you're taking an already known to be safe drug that's been approved to go into man, you cut so many years off.
I mean, but that's what people don't realize. You're cutting years off.
Years off.
Like this isn't like, oh, you know, okay, 6 months, whatever. This is literally years, because they've done all of the phase 1, 2, 3, et cetera, human trials and so on, which is massive.
Yeah.
Massive time saving.
If you look at, and again, I'm not an expert, but if you look at the thalidomides, which were used really early on for nausea in pregnancy with the results that obviously we all know about. But actually, they're used for patients with a multiple myeloma now, and they provide a lot of benefit. They slow the disease down massively. So again, that's an example of shift it to a completely different patient population, and the mechanism of action is exactly what's required in one case versus another.
And are there organizations, there must be, or researchers that are sort of scouring various clinical databases or wherever this stuff is sort of housed to try and make these connections about, okay, well, this thing works over there, but it could work over here? Or
there certainly are. And LifeArc has a portal on our website to help people actually go in and ask the right questions. And we will give assistance to actually help someone find out if there are opportunities for their particular unmet need.
I think that's fascinating. I mean, and to go back to your point, we'll do one more question and then we'll switch, because I know that you've got some exciting work that you've done with tuberculosis in Africa that I want to come to, which I think would be super interesting to talk about. But your point that you made earlier about patient engagement, now clearly I think that there's been such a huge amount of patient engagement driven by some of the high profile sufferers of MMD. And how important is that for getting funding and getting attention and getting progress in an area, a disease area?
I think it's absolutely wonderful. The amazing thing that in my history of working in pharma is that we haven't been close enough to the patient at this early stage. I find patients are curious, they're brave, they're open to new ideas, and you know, they're actually incredibly bold. So whilst all patients might prefer not to be in their situation and want a cure, at the same time they're incredible activists and enthusiasts, and they will give you really good insights into how just to make my life better. And it's amazing. So we get great heart from that. And in our respiratory work that we could talk about, they absolutely describe on a daily basis our patients in that area of respiratory, how we can help them relatively simply, rather than give them a cure.
Like how? Like give me some examples.
Well, the patients who have bronchiectasis or CF,
what's bronchiectasis? Yeah, you might have to break that one down.
That is a lung disease that actually stops the lung tissue being as nice and flexible as a normal healthy lung, and so they become very prone to infection in their lungs. And these patients describe their lives going from week to week, never knowing if the next week they're going to be well enough to do what they had planned. So they really beg us to help with the predictability and understanding if they're likely to go to an exacerbation. And then if they are, how do we avoid it? How do we stop
That's really interesting. We had someone on the show probably 12 months ago from a group called Spirit Health. I don't know if it was, what's the disease?
Bronchiectasis.
I don't know if it was that, but it was very similar around, I think it might have been COP, so chronic
COPD.
And exactly about that exacerbation issue, which was, if you can prevent or predict an exacerbation, it makes the patient's life just dramatically better.
Yeah.
So it's not like they want to never have them. They understand it will happen, but just if you can avoid it, great. But almost more just the knowledge that it could happen under certain circumstances, and that's really valuable.
So when we come back, I'll tell you a little bit about that Project Breathe, which is a project that really looks across technologies to predict those exacerbations.
You're running my show now. You're telling me I have to do a commercial break, which I do. Which I absolutely do. At least you're here, because otherwise I'd have just kept talking. So anyway, this is our last commercial break of the show. We'll be back in 2 minutes with my guest, Dr. Melanie Lee, the CEO of LifeArc. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Good. Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Dr. Melanie Lee, the CEO of LifeArc. Okay, so before you told me that we had to go for a commercial break, which was correct, I did, we were going to talk about Project Breathe in the respiratory disease area. So please carry on.
Okay, so our patients with bronchiectasis and cystic fibrosis say they want early detection. They want of infection. They want to know the right diagnosis of the pathogen that they may be suffering from, and they want better treatment all round. So Project Breathe is an AI technology. It uses signals from home monitoring equipment, which measures oxygen levels, lung function, activity, weight, and pulse rate, for example, to predict those future exacerbations or flare-ups, and sometimes 10 days more earlier than perhaps the patient might know. So the AI technology will allow treatment to be given earlier. It should prevent or minimize that exacerbation, which throws patients' lives into turmoil. And potentially, it should protect the long-term lung damage that can occur because of those exacerbations. So it really helps people to be managed at home. Mm-hmm. And it's a project that we're doing with the NIH, with the National Institute for Health Research. So it's and at Papworth Hospital. So yeah. It's really exciting, that one.
We've worked with the NIHR before. They're amazing. So all of our NHS work has been in conjunction with the NIHR. So totally appreciate how great those guys are. Is there a private company involved in that as well, providing the AI, or is it kind of homegrown within the NHS? Just curious, or the NIHR?
I think it's mainly come from the NHS research itself, but it's probably involving a number of smaller players. I don't know the details of that.
I was just curious. So I think that that's great. And the reason why that's great is that none of those, at least I guess, none of those particular, those markers or those pieces of data are particularly expensive to gather.
That's
right. You know, like you're not talking about hugely invasive diagnostics. You're not involving a laboratory. A lot of the time, these patients might have those pieces of devices, equipment anyway, pulsometer, pulse oximeter. Mm-hmm. You know, these things are not that, if you're suffering from a chronic condition, you may well have those things anyway. You know, and actually just writing the software to be able to combine those into a predictive model is also not crazily complicated. No. And so it's just that's such a sensible plan.
Yeah. That's
such a great, simple thing to do. Right.
And again, it empowers the patient. It allows them in their homes to live their lives. And, you know, this is what patients ask for. They really want to live normal lives. Yeah,
and also, again, without wishing to sort of, you know, be, I don't know, £2 and pence about the whole thing, but it's what the health system wants as well. They want people in their houses living their lives. They don't want people having had a massive exacerbated, you know, attack and being in A&E, for example.
I was a bit shocked when I heard them talk about the side effects of the high dose antibiotics they have to have as well. When I heard them that so each and we talk also about this ongoing lung damage with each exacerbation. So it really is important to help them and empower them. And so Project Breathe is very important to us.
And how kind of effective is that process? Do you have any information to say, well, people that are on and follow that sort of pathway are X times less likely to have an exacerbation or end up in hospital? Is that data come through there, or is it still being worked on?
It's not yet mature. It's ongoing as a clinical study. So hopefully we will be able to enroll. I think it's 450 patients we want in a UK-wide study. So we will be able to obviously statistically prove the benefits of that to the patient.
Yeah, and you'll get great qualitative data off of that as well. You know, patient stories and things like that. Okay, so are you doing, did you want to talk about the stuff in Africa with tuberculosis as well?
Yes, I do. So that's a research diagnostic test that we have built ourselves.
Okay.
From our Edinburgh site, who are accredited diagnostic site. And it is a live bacterial load assay. So it is an assay that was developed with Stephen Gillespie, who's a senior professor in Scotland also. And we've taken the assay measures live TB bacteria. So now we're in four clinical sites in Africa. Mm-hmm. And so it was St. Andrews Gillespie's at. So it's four clinical sites in Africa, and we have their TB monitoring sites. So they will mm-hmm. actually take a lot of patients in on a daily and weekly basis, and they will give them varying treatments. The problem with previous assays is that you measure not live bacterial load, but you can measure in the sputum of these patients the bacterium, the TB bacterium. But actually, if you want to look at the effectiveness of therapy, you need to see whether or not these bacteria are alive.
Okay.
And so our product is actually quite different to previous products.
Is it a mouth swab or is it a spit?
It's a sputum. It's a okay. sputum measure of live bacteria. So we started in January 23. We've got 364 patients total to be recruited, and we're well on our way with, I think it's upwards of 30 or so patients
okay.
now already.
Great.
And we will be able to inform the medics treating these patients whether the therapy that they're being put on, because there are a number of different therapies, is actually effective in that patient's case.
That's massive, because otherwise, I guess previously, in order to get that data, it would have been a lab test, right? Blood draw, lab test,
yeah.
Whether the person comes back again in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, where's the local pathology lab, who's paying for that? You
yeah.
know, I think that that's a real step forward. I mean, look, we're obviously at PocDoc, we're a clear fan and believer in point of care testing in all its forms, mm-hmm. manifest forms, assuming that it's safe and accurate and performed responsibly. But yeah, I think that's great. That's really great.
It is good, and it's done quickly. It's done on site. So I think there's an awful lot of benefit. And so at the moment, our diagnostic is being tested itself to see if it effectively can track response to therapy. Once it's proven to be able to do that and helpful to the medics and the patients, then of course the door will open for it to become a more commercial or broadly available test, and we will hope to work with organizations that will help to get it out there into
I mean there's plenty though. So we work with PATH, which is part of the it's sort of connected to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's also part of the Global Access Alliance and things like that. So we've developed a polio rapid test using our smartphone technology. So that can be deployed in remote areas of Pakistan, Senegal, Tunisia, polio hotspots, basically. So it's a lateral flow, which can be read by our PocDoc software and automatically integrated back with the surveillance authorities, the central digital hub. So, you know, mostly to kind of a similar use case as you, but even further remote and even further rural. I completely understand the use case for that. And I think I'm sure that some of those global access or, you know, organizations would be really interested in that.
Absolutely. No, we can extend that type of methodology into other diseases as well. So we're intending to do that for
great.
Another translational challenge that will come and be announced quite soon, which is a global health, which will look at neglected tropical diseases, viral threats, and antimicrobial resistance. All three very key issues for the world.
Huge possible black swan events, right? Like any one of those things, you know, fungal, antimicrobial resistance, any of those things could be a really bad thing that can happen.
Really bad. So yeah. that'll be life art going beyond our UK borders, particularly, and it's all around that global health.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I think that clearly, and this is a really nice segue into what I wanted to talk about now, by the way, the UK clearly has a unique attitude towards life science, scientific innovation, scientific development at that early stage, I think is really, really, really strong in that. And I know that that's obviously a big part of what the government wants to push as well, which is all well and good. And I think taking that, exporting that sort of mentality to other areas of the world is a really, really good thing that we can do. But what's your view generally about the sort of, I don't know, broader landscape, you know, in the UK and this idea that science and technology is the sort of powerhouse or one of the powerhouses of the future UK economy? And, you know, do you feel like that we're set up for that to be the case? And like, I don't know, what are your thoughts?
It's really interesting. I think about it often because we want to make the most of the UK. So we've got a fantastic research base. We always say that. We need translation, and we particularly need translation, I think, in life sciences, because we had a lot of pharma companies here and they naturally did do that preclinical and early translational work. And they're changing their model as they get bigger and bigger. Not all of them, but a large number have withdrawn from this very high risk space. And yet at the same time, we've got a really vibrant venture pool, you know, and some of money coming in from the US as well. So we've got an enormous opportunity in the UK. But what we must do is make sure our science is mixed, the science base is mixed, because I think the old model of developing a therapeutic absent knowledge of your patient population is actually not going to give us the best opportunity. The new science for new modalities is so incredible that you can fix genes in individuals and give them fully functioning and long lives. That is doesn't fit the old commercial model of these big companies. So I think the future is multi-tech working together. The UK has everything it needs to do that. Yeah. And what we must try and do, and I do see really innovative venture companies springing up now who recognize that the return on investment of multi-tech investments is just as good as it would have been if you'd been very fixated on therapies. Yeah. And recently spoke with a group who are really looking at rare diseases, and they say as long as the therapeutic benefit that you can envision can be achieved with the science, the commercial return will be there because of because you offset it exactly as you said with the previous cost you would have paid to care for a patient who just carried on having their disease. Yeah. So there's enormous seed change, and it's the answers will come from multi-tech working together.
So the thing that blew me away, we had a guy on here, he's a really nice guy called Jason C. Foster, who is kind of one of the sort of leading figures in the tech bio space. I don't know if you've come across tech bio, which is it's kind of like what you just sort of talked about a little bit, which is, you know, we already have some therapies that have been developed and clinically approved, but we can't manufacture them at a scale or a price that is anywhere close to being acceptable. So they're hugely effective. Right. So someone's gone out and done all the clinical work and got all the approvals and done all of that good stuff. But now there's actually weirdly a kind of a manufacturing issue. But because of the way the therapies are, they're biological therapies, personalized gene therapies, CAR T cell therapies that harvest your own T cells and reprogram them and so on. This is not like, you know, pill packing. Okay. There's like a heavy biological, biochemical, sort of infrastructure that's required, as well as the sort of engineering, manufacturing, high throughput, you know, scalability component to it. I think that stuff's really, really interesting. And that's definitely a completely new modality, because it's neither drug discovery, because it's already been discovered, it's already been approved, nor is it just straight out manufacturing, productization, scale up. It's sort of somewhere between the two. I think it's super interesting.
And I'm a great believer in as long as once people have proven, and I'd always rather they prove that the type of modality can create the benefit that we hope for, then there are so many creative people who can do production technology, who can innovate around that, who can take things that were very, very resource intensive and miniaturize them or make them commercially viable. There really are. I just hope our venture investors will recognize that can be done. And then actually being able to cure people who would inevitably die at the age of 5, but actually you give them lives, just like we recently had from Orchard Therapeutics, the little MLD babies who, if they're actually caught before the age of 2 and their stem cells are changed to produce a missing enzyme, they will actually live normal lives.
Is that so, right? What's MLD?
It's metachromatic leukodystrophy, but it's a very rare disease. If babies don't show symptoms till they're about 2, But if you actually treat them before the age of two, then they should live normal lives. It's incredible.
Wow.
Technology is astounding. I have every belief we can get the production right ultimately.
Wow, that's amazing. That, I mean, how fantastic is that? But also, you know, the pressure on being able to get that out there at some scale to make sure we don't miss any of those babies.
Well, they're real pioneers, they've done a fantastic job.
So we've got 1 minute left. And a last show I got told off by my producer, Johan, because we went over. So just before we go, if you had any advice to anyone who's currently being a scientist, wants to be a scientist, trying to found a scientific adventure, what would your advice be?
Don't give up. Be totally resilient. And what I always say to anybody who's an entrepreneur, whenever somebody tells you a reason why something can't work, say, thank you very much. I really appreciate your input. And then go away and work out how you're going to get around that problem. So my motto is outperform those critics and come back with solutions.
I love it. There's nothing else to say. On that note, Dr. Melanie Lee, the CEO of LifeArc, thank you very much for coming on the show. Where do people go if they want to find out more about LifeArc? What's the web address?
LifeArc.org.
LifeArc.org. Okay, guys, thank you very much for listening. Melanie, thank you for coming on. We'll be back again next week. Thank you.